The worst American body wasn't Billy's. The worst body belonged to a car thief from Cicero, Illinois. His name was Paul Lazaro. He was tiny, and not only were his bones and teeth rotten, but his skin was disgusting. Lazaro was polka-dotted all over with dime-sized scars. He had had many plagues of boils. Lazaro, too, had been on Roland Weary's boxcar and had given his word of honor to Weary that he would find some way to make Billy Pilgrim pay for Weary's death. He was looking around now, wondering which naked human being was Billy. An unseen hand turned a master valve. Out of the showerheads gushed scalding rain. The rain was a blowtorch that did not warm. It jazzed and jangled Billy's skin without thawing the ice in the marrow of his long bones. The American's clothes were meanwhile passing through poison gas. Body lice and bacteria and fleas were dying by the billions. So it goes. And Billy zoomed back in time to his infancy. He was a baby who had just been bathed by his mother. Now his mother wrapped him in a towel, carried him into a rosy room that was filled with sunshine. She unwrapped him, laid him on the tickling towel, powdered him between his legs, joked with him, patted his little jelly belly. Her palm on his little jelly belly made potching sounds. Billy gurgled and cooed. And then Billy was aboard a flying saucer, which was bound for Tralfamador. "Where am I?" said Billy Pilgrim.
"Trapped in another blob of amber, Mr. Pilgrim. We are where we have to be just now, 300 million miles from Earth, bound for a time warp which will get us to Tralfamador in hours rather than centuries."
How did I get here?
It would take another Earthling to explain it to you. Earthlings are the great explainers, explaining why this event is structured as it is, telling how other events may be achieved or avoided. I am a Tralfamadorian, seeing all time as you might see a stretch of rocky mountains. All time is all time. It does not change. It does not lend itself to warnings or explanations. It simply is. Take it moment by moment, and you will find that we are all, as I've said before, bugs in amber.
You sound to me as though you don't believe in free will, said Billy Pilgrim.
If I hadn't spent so much time studying Earthlings, said the Tralfamadorian, I wouldn't have any idea what was meant by free will. I've visited 31 inhabited planets in the universe, and I have studied reports on 100 more. Only on Earth is there any talk of free will.
Billy asked for something to read on the trip to Tralfamador. His captors had only one actual book in English, which would be placed in a Tralfamadorian museum. It was Valley of the Dolls by Jacqueline Suzanne. Billy read it, thought it was pretty good in spots. The people in it certainly had their ups and downs. But Billy didn't want to read about the same ups and downs over and over again. He asked if there wasn't, please, some other reading matter around.
Only Tralfamadorian novels, which I'm afraid you couldn't begin to understand, said the speaker on the wall.
Let me look at one anyway. So they sent him in several. Billy couldn't read Tralfamadorian, of course, but he could at least see how the books were laid out, in brief clumps of symbols separated by stars.
Each clump of symbols is a brief, urgent message describing a situation, a scene. We Tralfamadorians read them all at once, not one after the other. There isn't any particular relationship between all the messages, except that the author has chosen them carefully, so that when seen all at once, they produce an image of life that is beautiful and surprising and deep. There is no beginning, no middle, no end, no suspense, no moral, no causes, no effects. What we love in our books are the depths of many marvelous moments seen all at one time. Moments after that, Billy found himself back in the war, back in the delousing station again. The shower was over. An unseen hand had turned the water off. Billy Pilgrim dressed himself. He put on the little overcoat, too. It split up the back, and at the shoulders, the sleeves came entirely free. So the coat became a fur-collared vest. It was meant to flare at its owner's waist, but the flaring took place at Billy's armpits. The Germans found him to be one of the most screamingly funny things they had seen in all of the Second World War. They laughed and laughed. Properly enrolled and tagged, the Americans were led through gate after gate. In 2 days' time now, their families would learn from the International Red Cross that they were alive. "Halt," said a guard. The Americans halted. They stood there quietly in the cold. The sheds they were among were outwardly like thousands of other sheds they had passed. There was this difference, though. The sheds had tin chimneys, and out of the chimneys whirled constellations of sparks. A guard knocked on a door. The door was flung open from inside. Light leaped out through the door, escaped from prison at 186,000 miles per second. Out marched 50 middle-aged Englishmen. They were singing, "Hail, hail, the gang's all here," from the Pirates of Penzance. The Englishmen were officers. Each of them had attempted to escape from another prison at least once. Now they were here, dead center in a sea of dying Russians. The Englishmen were clean and enthusiastic and decent and strong. They sang boomingly well. They had been singing together every night for years. The Englishmen had also been lifting weights and chinning themselves for years. Their bellies were like washboards. They were among the wealthiest people in Europe in terms of food. A clerical error early in the war, when food was still getting through to prisoners, had caused the Red Cross to ship them 500 parcels every month instead of 50. They were adored by the Germans, who thought they were exactly what the Englishmen ought to be. They made war look stylish and reasonable and fun. So the Germans let them have 4 sheds, though 1 shed would have held them all. And in exchange for coffee or chocolate or tobacco, the Germans gave them paint and lumber and nails and cloth for fixing things up. The Englishmen had known for 12 hours that American guests were on their way. They had never had guests before, and they went to work like darling elves, sweeping, mopping, cooking, baking, making mattresses of straw and burlap bags, setting tables, putting party favors at each place. Now they were singing their welcome to their guests in the winter night. They wrestled the Americans toward the shed door affectionately, filling the night with manly blather and brotherly rodomontades. They called them Yank, told them good show, promised them that Jerry was on the run, and so on. Billy Pilgrim wondered dimly who Jerry was. Indoors there were long tables set for a banquet. At each place was a bowl made from a can that had once contained powdered milk. A smaller can was a cup. A taller, more slender can was a tumbler. Each tumbler was filled with warm milk. At each place was a safety razor, a washcloth, a package of razor blades, a chocolate bar, 2 cigars, a bar of soap, 10 cigarettes, a book of matches, a pencil, and a candle. Only the candles and the soap were of German origin. They had a ghostly, opalescent similarity. The British had no way of knowing it, but the candles and the soap were made from the fat of rendered Jews and gypsies and fairies and communists and other enemies of the state. So it goes. And at the far end of the shed, Billy saw pink arches with azure draperies hanging between them, and an enormous clock and 2 golden thrones, and a bucket and a mop.
It was in this setting that the evening's entertainment would take place, a musical version of Cinderella, the most popular story ever told. Billy Pilgrim swooned. Billy came to on a chair facing the stage. He had somehow eaten, and now he was watching Cinderella. Some part of him had evidently been enjoying the performance for quite a while. Billy was laughing hard. The women in the play were really men, of course. The clock had just struck midnight, and Cinderella was lamenting, "Goodness me, the clock has struck, alack-a-day, and fuck my luck." Billy found the couplet so comical that he not only laughed, he shrieked. He went on shrieking until he was carried out of the shed and into another, where the hospital was. It was a 6-bed hospital. There weren't any other patients in there. Billy was put to bed and tied down and given a shot of morphine. Another American volunteered to watch over him. This volunteer was Edgar Derby, the high school teacher who would be shot to death in Dresden. So it goes. He woke up with his head under a blanket in a ward for non-violent mental patients in a veterans hospital near Lake Placid, New York. It was springtime in 1948, 3 years after the end of the war. Billy uncovered his head. The windows of the ward were open. Birds were twittering outside. "Pooty wheat?" one asked him. The sun was high. There were 29 other patients assigned to the ward, but they were all outdoors now, enjoying the day. They were free to come and go as they pleased, to go home even, if they liked. And so was Billy Pilgrim. They had come here voluntarily, alarmed by the outside world. Billy had committed himself in the middle of his final year at the Ilium School of Optometry. Nobody else suspected that he was going crazy. Everybody else thought he looked fine and was acting fine. Now he was in the hospital. The doctors agreed he was going crazy. The man assigned to the bed next to Billy's was a former infantry captain named Elliot Rosewater. Rosewater was sick and tired of being drunk all the time. It was Rosewater who introduced Billy to science fiction, and in particular to the writings of Kilgore Trout. Rosewater had a tremendous collection of science fiction paperbacks under his bed. He had brought them to the hospital in a steamer trunk. Those beloved frumpish books gave off a smell that permeated the ward, like flannel pajamas that hadn't been changed for a month, or like Irish stew. Kilgore Trout became Billy's favorite living author, and science fiction became the only sort of tales he could read. Rosewater and Billy were dealing with similar crises in similar ways. They had both found life meaningless, partly because of what they had seen in war. So they were trying to reinvent themselves and their universe. Science fiction was a big help. Rosewater said an interesting thing to Billy one time about a book that wasn't science fiction. He said that everything there was to know about life was in The Brothers Karamazov by Fyodor Dostoevsky. "But that isn't enough anymore," said Rosewater. Another time Billy heard Rosewater say to a psychiatrist, "I think you guys are going to have to come up with a lot of wonderful new lies, or people just aren't going to want to go on living." And Billy traveled in time to the zoo on Tralfamador. He was 44 years old, on display under a geodesic dome. He was reclining on the lounge chair, which had been his cradle during his trip through space. He was naked. The Tralfamadorians were interested in his body, all of it. There were thousands of them outside, holding up their little hands so that their eyes could see him. Billy had been on Tralfamador for 6 Earthling months now. He was used to the crowd. Escape was out of the question. The atmosphere outside the dome was cyanide, and Earth was 446,120,000,000,000 miles away. Billy was displayed there in the zoo in a simulated Earthling habitat. Most of the furnishings had been stolen from the Sears and Roebuck warehouse in Iowa City, Iowa. There was a color television set and a couch that could be converted into a bed. There were end tables with lamps and ashtrays on them by the couch. There was a home bar and 2 stools. There was a little pool table. There was wall-to-wall carpeting in federal gold, except in the kitchen and bathroom areas, and over the iron manhole cover in the center of the floor. There were magazines arranged in a fan on the coffee table in front of the couch. There was a stereophonic phonograph. The phonograph worked. The television didn't. There was a picture of one cowboy killing another one pasted to the television tube. So it goes. There were no walls in the dome, nor a place for Billy to hide. The mint-green bathroom fixtures were right out in the open. Billy got off his lounge chair now, went into the bathroom, and took a leak. The crowd went wild. Billy brushed his teeth on Tralfamador, put in his partial denture, and went into his kitchen. His bottled gas range and his refrigerator and his dishwasher were mint-green, too. There was a picture painted on the door of the refrigerator. The refrigerator had come that way. It was a picture of a gay 90s couple on a bicycle built for two. Billy looked at that picture now, tried to think of something about the couple. Nothing came to him. There didn't seem to be anything to think about those two people. Billy ate a good breakfast from cans. He washed his cup and plate and knife and fork and spoon and saucepan, put them away. Then he did exercises he had learned in the army. Straddle jumps, deep knee bends, sit-ups and push-ups. Most Tralfamadorians had no way of knowing Billy's body and face were not beautiful. They supposed that he was a splendid specimen. This had a pleasant effect on Billy, who began to enjoy his body for the first time. He showered after his exercises and trimmed his toenails. He shaved and sprayed deodorant under his arms, while a zoo guide on a raised platform outside explained what Billy was doing and why. The guide was lecturing telepathically, simply standing there, sending out thought waves to the crowd. On the platform with him was the little keyboard instrument with which he would relay questions to Billy from the crowd. Now the first question came from the speaker on the television set.
Are you happy here?
About as happy as I was on Earth, said Billy Pilgrim, which was true. There were five sexes on Tralfamador, each of them performing a step necessary in the creation of a new individual. They looked identical to Billy because their sex differences were all in the fourth dimension. One of the biggest moral bombshells handed to Billy by the Tralfamadorians, incidentally, had to do with sex on Earth. They said their flying saucer crews had identified no fewer than seven sexes on Earth, each essential to reproduction. Again, Billy couldn't possibly imagine what five of those seven sexes had to do with the making of a baby, since they were sexually active only in the fourth dimension. The Tralfamadorians tried to give Billy clues that would help him imagine sex in the invisible dimension. They told him that there could be no earthling babies without male homosexuals. There could be babies without female homosexuals. There couldn't be babies without women over 65 years old. There could be babies without men over 65. There couldn't be babies without other babies who had lived an hour or less after birth. And so on. It was gibberish to Billy. There was a lot that Billy said that was gibberish to the Tralfamadorians, too. They couldn't imagine what time looked like to him. Billy had given up on explaining that. The guide outside had to explain as best he could. The guide invited the crowd to imagine that they were looking across a desert at a mountain range on a day that was twinkling bright and clear. They could look at a peak or a bird or a cloud, at a stone right in front of them, or even down into a canyon behind them. But among them was this poor earthling, and his head was encased in a steel sphere which he could never take off. There was only one eye hole through which he could look, and welded to that eye hole were 6 feet of pipe. This was only the beginning of Billy's miseries in the metaphor. He was also strapped to a steel lattice which was bolted to a flat car on rails, and there was no way he could turn his head or touch the pipe. The far end of the pipe rested on a bipod which was also bolted to the flat car. All Billy could see was the dot at the end of the pipe. He didn't know he was on a flat car, didn't even know there was anything peculiar about his situation. The flat car sometimes crept, sometimes went extremely fast, often stopped, went uphill, downhill, around curves, along straightaways. Whatever poor Billy saw through the pipe, he had no choice but to say to himself, "That's life." Billy expected the Tralfamadorians to be baffled and alarmed by all the wars and other forms of murder on Earth. He expected them to fear that the Earthling combination of ferocity and spectacular weaponry might eventually destroy part or maybe all of the innocent universe. Science fiction had led him to expect that. But the subject of war never came up until Billy brought it up himself. Somebody in the zoo crowd asked him through the lecturer what the most valuable thing he had learned on Tralfamador was so far, and Billy replied, "How the inhabitants of a whole planet can live in peace. So tell me the secret, so I can take it back to Earth and save us all. How can a planet live at peace?" Billy was baffled when he saw the Tralfamadorians close their little hands on their eyes. He knew from past experience what this meant. He was being stupid. Would you mind telling me, he said to the guide, much deflated, what was so stupid about that?
"We know how the universe ends," said the guide, "and Earth has nothing to do with it except that it gets wiped out too."
How does the universe end?" said Billy.
"We blow it up, experimenting with new fuels for our flying saucers. A Tralfamadorian test pilot presses a starter button, and the whole universe disappears."
"So it goes." "If you know this," said Billy, "isn't there some way you can prevent it? Can't you keep the pilot from pressing the button?"
"He has always pressed it, and he always will. We always let him, and we always will let him. The moment is structured that way."
"So," said Billy gropingly, "I suppose that the idea of preventing war on Earth is stupid, too."
"Of course.
But you do have a peaceful planet here."
"Today we do. On other days we have wars as horrible as any you've ever seen or read about. There isn't anything we can do about them, so we simply don't look at them. We ignore them. We spend eternity looking at pleasant moments, like today at the zoo. Isn't this a nice moment?"
"Yes."
"That's one thing Earthlings might learn to do if they tried hard enough. Ignore the awful times and concentrate on the good ones."
Said Billy Pilgrim. Shortly after he went to sleep that night, Billy traveled in time to another moment which was quite nice, his wedding night with the former Valencia Merble. He had been out of the Veterans Hospital for 6 months. He was all well. He had graduated from the Ilium School of Optometry, third in his class of 47. Now he was in bed with Valencia in a delightful studio apartment which was built on the end of a wharf on Cape Ann, Massachusetts. Across the water were the lights of Gloucester. Billy was on top of Valencia, making love to her. One result of this act would be the birth of Robert Pilgrim, who would become a problem in high school, but who would then straighten out as a member of the famous Green Berets. Valencia wasn't a time traveler, but she did have a lively imagination. While Billy was making love to her, she imagined that she was a famous woman in history. She was being Queen Elizabeth I of England, and Billy was supposedly Christopher Columbus. Billy made a noise like a small rusty hinge. He had just emptied his seminal vesicles into Valencia, had contributed his share of the Green Beret. According to the Tralfamadorians, of course, the Green Beret would have 7 parents in all. The candle in the hospital had gone out. Poor old Edgar Derby had fallen asleep on the cot next to Billy's. Billy was out of bed, groping along a wall, trying to find a way out because he had to take a leak so badly. He suddenly found a door, which opened, let him reel out into the prison night. Billy took his pecker out and peed on the ground. Somewhere in the night there were cries of grief. With nothing better to do, Billy shuffled in their direction. He wondered what tragedy so many had found to lament out of doors. Billy was approaching, without knowing it, the back of the latrine. Billy moved along the screen and reached a point where he could see a message freshly painted on the tar paper wall. The words were written with the same pink paint which had brightened the set for Cinderella. Please leave this latrine as tidy as you found it. Billy looked inside the latrine. The wailing was coming from in there. The place was crammed with Americans who had taken their pants down. The welcome feast had made them as sick as volcanoes. An American near Billy wailed that he had excreted everything but his brains. Moments later, he said, "There they go, there they go." He meant his brains. That was I, that was me. That was the author of this book. At 3 a.m. on Billy's morphine night in prison, a new patient was carried into the hospital by 2 lusty Englishmen. He was tiny. He was Paul Lazaro, the polka-dotted car thief from Cicero, Illinois. He had been caught stealing cigarettes from under the pillow of an Englishman. The Englishman, half asleep, had broken Lazaro's right arm and knocked him unconscious. A German major came in now. He was apologetic about the Englishman's having to put up with the American enlisted men. He promised them that they would not be inconvenienced for more than a day or two, that the Americans would soon be shipped to Dresden as contract labor. He had a monograph with him, published by the German Association of Prison Officials. It was a report on the behavior in Germany of American enlisted men as prisoners of war. It was written by a former American who had risen high in the German Ministry of Propaganda. His name was Howard W. Campbell, Jr. He would later hang himself while awaiting trial as a war criminal. So it goes. While the British colonel said Lazaro's broken arm and mixed plaster for the cast, the German major translated out loud passages from Howard W. Campbell, Jr.'s monograph. Campbell had been a fairly well-known playwright at one time. His opening line was this one. America is the wealthiest nation on earth, but its people are mainly poor, and poor Americans are urged to hate themselves. It is, in fact, a crime for an American to be poor, even though America is a nation of poor. Every other nation has folk traditions of men who are poor, but extremely wise and virtuous, and therefore more estimable than anyone with power and gold. No such tales are told by the American poor. They mock themselves and glorify their betters. The meanest eating or drinking establishment owned by a man who is himself poor is very likely to have a sign on his wall asking this cruel question: if you're so smart, why ain't you rich? There will also be an American flag no larger than a child's hand, glued to a lollipop stick and flying from the cash register. The author of the monograph, a native of Schenectady, New York, was said by some to have had the highest IQ of all the war criminals who were made to face a death by hanging. So it goes. Campbell told what the German experience with captured American enlisted men had been. They were known everywhere to be the most self-pitying, least fraternal, and dirtiest of all prisoners of war, said Campbell. They were incapable of concerted action on their own behalf. They despised any leader from among their own number, refused to follow or even listen to him on the grounds that he was no better than they were, that he should stop putting on airs, and so on. Billy Pilgrim went to sleep, woke up as a widower in his empty home in Ilium. His daughter Barbara was reproaching him for writing ridiculous letters to the newspapers. When Barbara left, slamming the door behind her, Billy traveled in time to the zoo on Tralfamador again. A mate had just been brought to him from Earth. She was Montana Wildhack, a motion picture star. Montana was under heavy sedation. Tralfamadorians wearing gas masks brought her in, put her on Billy's yellow lounge chair, withdrew through his airlock. The vast crowd outside was delighted. All attendance records for the zoo were broken. Everybody on the planet wanted to see Earthling's mate. Montana was naked, and so was Billy, of course. He had a tremendous wang, incidentally. You never know who'll get one. Now she fluttered her eyelids. Her lashes were like buggy whips. "Where am I?" she said. "Everything is all right," said Billy gently. "Please don't be afraid." Montana had been unconscious during her trip from Earth. The Tralfamadorians hadn't talked to her, hadn't shown themselves to her. The last thing she remembered was sunning herself by a swimming pool in Palm Springs, California. Montana was only 20 years old. Around her neck was a silver chain with a heart-shaped locket hanging from it, between her breasts. Now she turned her head to see the myriads of Tralfamadorians outside the dome. They were applauding her by opening and closing their little green hands quickly. Montana screamed and screamed. All the little green hands closed tight because Montana's terror was so unpleasant to see. The head zookeeper ordered a crane operator who was standing by to drop a navy blue canopy over the dome, thus simulating Earthling night inside. Real night came to the zoo for only one Earthling hour out of every 62. Billy switched on a floor lamp. The light from the single source threw the baroque detailing of Montana's body into sharp relief. Billy was reminded of fantastic architecture in Dresden before it was bombed. In time, Montana came to love and trust Billy Pilgrim. He did not touch her until she made it clear that she wanted him to. After she'd been on Tralfamador for what would have been an Earthling week, she asked him shyly if he wouldn't sleep with her. Which he did. It was heavenly. Listen. Billy Pilgrim says he went to Dresden, Germany on the day after his morphine night in the British compound in the center of the extermination camp for Russian prisoners of war. Billy woke up at dawn on that day in January. There were no windows in the little hospital, and the ghostly candles had gone out, so the only light came from pinprick holes in the walls and from a sketchy rectangle that outlined the imperfectly fitted door. Little Paul Lazaro, with a broken arm, lay on one bed. Edgar Derby, the high school teacher who would eventually be shot, on another. Lazaro said that he could have anybody in the world killed for $1,000 plus traveling expenses. He had a list in his head, he said. Derby asked him who all was on the list, and Lazaro said, "Just fucking make sure you don't get on it. Just don't cross me, that's all." There was a silence, and then he added, "And don't cross my friends." "You have friends?" Derby wanted to know. "In the war," said Lazaro. "Yeah, I had a friend in the war. He's dead." "So it goes." "That's too bad." Lazaro's eyes were twinkling again. "Yeah, he was my buddy on the boxcar. His name was Roland Weary. He died in my arms." Now he pointed to Billy with his one mobile hand. "He died on account of this silly cocksucker here, so I promised him I'd have this silly cocksucker shot after the war." Lazaro erased with his hand anything Billy Pilgrim might be about to say. "Just forget about it, kid," he said. "Enjoy life while you can. Nothing's going to happen for maybe 5, 10, 15, 20 years, but let me give you a piece of advice. Whenever the doorbell rings, have somebody else answer the door." Billy Pilgrim says now that this really is the way he is going to die, too. As a time traveler, he has seen his own death many times, has described it to a tape recorder. The tape is locked up with his will and some other valuables in his safe deposit box at the Ilium Merchants National Bank and Trust, he says. "I, Billy Pilgrim," the tape begins, "will die, have died, and always will die on February 13th, 1976. At the time of his death, he says, he is in Chicago to address a large crowd on the subject of flying saucers and the true nature of time. His home is still in Ilium. He has had to cross 3 international boundaries in order to reach Chicago. The United States of America has been balkanized, has been divided into 20 petty nations so that it will never again be a threat to world peace. Chicago has been hydrogen bombed by angry Chinamen. So it goes. It is all brand new." Billy is speaking before a capacity audience in a baseball park which is covered by a geodesic dome. The flag of the country is behind him. It is a Hereford bull on a field of green. Billy predicts his own death within an hour. He laughs about it, invites the crowd to laugh with him. "It is high time I was dead," he says. "Many years ago," he says, "a certain man promised to have me killed. He is an old man now, living not far from here. He has read all the publicity associated with my appearance in your fair city. He is insane. Tonight, he will keep his promise." There are protests from the crowds. Billy Pilgrim rebukes them. "If you protest, if you think that death is a terrible thing, then you have not understood a word I've said." Now he closes his speech, as he closes every speech, with these words: "Farewell, hello, farewell, hello." There are police around him as he leaves the stage. They are there to protect him from the crush of popularity. No threats on his life have been made since 1945. The police offer to stay with him. They are floridly willing to stand in a circle around him all night with their zap guns drawn. "No, no," says Billy serenely. "It is time for you to go home to your wives and children, and it is time for me to be dead for a little while and then live again." At that moment, Billy's high forehead is in the crosshairs of a high-powered laser gun. It is aimed at him from the darkened press box. In the next moment, Billy Pilgrim is dead. So it goes. So, Billy experiences death for a while. It is simply violet light and a hum. There isn't anybody else there. Not even Billy Pilgrim is there. Then he swings back into life again, all the way back to 1945. He and Lazaro and poor old Edgar Derby are to join their fellows in the theater. The theater was paved with American bodies that nestled like spoons. Most of the Americans were in stupors or asleep. Their guts were fluttering, dry. The stage was still set for Cinderella. Azure curtains hung from the arches, which were shocking pink. There were golden thrones and the dummy clock, whose hands were set at midnight. Cinderella's slippers, which were airmen's boots painted silver, were capsized side by side under a golden throne. Billy and poor old Edgar Derby and Lazaro had been in the hospital when the British passed out blankets and mattresses, so they had none. They had to improvise. The only space open to them was up on the stage, and they went up there, pulled the azure curtains down, made nests. Billy, curled in his azure nest, found himself staring at Cinderella's silver boots under a throne. And then he remembered that his shoes were ruined, that he needed boots. He hated to get out of his nest, but he forced himself to do it. He crawled to the boots on all fours, sat, tried them on. The boots fit perfectly. Billy Pilgrim was Cinderella, and Cinderella was Billy Pilgrim. The temperature climbed startlingly that day. The noontime was balmy. The Germans brought soup and bread in two-wheel carts which were pulled by Russians. The Englishmen sent over real coffee and sugar and marmalade and cigarettes and cigars, and the doors of the theater were left open so the warmth could get in. The Americans began to feel much better. They were able to hold their food. And then it was time to go to Dresden. The Americans marched fairly stylishly out of the British compound. Billy Pilgrim again led the parade. He had silver boots now and a piece of azure curtain which he wore like a toga. The trip to Dresden was a lark. It only took 2 hours. Shriveled little bellies were full. Sunlight and mild air came in through the ventilators. There were plenty of smokes from the Englishmen. The Americans arrived in Dresden at 5 p.m. The boxcars were opened, and the doorways framed the loveliest city that most of the Americans had ever seen. The skyline was intricate and voluptuous and enchanted and absurd. It looked like a Sunday school picture of heaven to Billy Pilgrim. Somebody behind him in the boxcar said, "Oz." That was I. That was me. The only other city I'd ever seen was Indianapolis, Indiana. Every other big city in Germany had been bombed and burned ferociously. Dresden had not suffered so much as a cracked window pane. Sirens went off every day, but the planes were always bound for someplace else. Steam radiators still whistled cheerily in Dresden. Streetcars clanged. Telephones rang and were answered. Lights went on and off when switches were clicked. There were theaters and restaurants. There was a zoo. The principal enterprises of the city were medicine and food processing and the making of cigarettes. People were going home from work now in the late afternoon. They were tired. So, out of the gate of the railroad yard and into the streets of Dresden marched the light opera of which Billy Pilgrim was the star. He led the parade. Thousands of people were on the sidewalks, going home from work. They were watery and putty-colored, having eaten mostly potatoes during the last 2 years. They had expected no blessings beyond the mildness of the day. Suddenly, here was fun. Billy did not meet many of the eyes that found him so entertaining. He was enchanted by the architecture of the city. Mary Amoretti wove garlands above windows. Roguish fauns and naked nymphs peeked down at Billy from festooned cornices. Stone monkeys frisked among scrolls and seashells and bamboo. Billy, with his memories of the future, knew that the city would be smashed to smithereens and then burned in about 30 more days. He knew, too, that most of the people watching him would soon be dead. So it goes. The parade pranced, staggered, and reeled to the gate of the Dresden slaughterhouse, and then it went inside. The slaughterhouse wasn't a busy place anymore. Almost all the hooved animals in Germany had been killed and eaten by human beings, mostly soldiers. So it goes. The Americans were taken to the fifth building inside the gate. It was a one-story cement block cube with sliding doors in front and back. It had been built as a shelter for pigs about to be butchered. Now it was going to serve as a home away from home for 100 American prisoners of war. There were bunks in there and two pot-bellied stoves and a water tap. Behind it was a latrine, which was a one-rail fence with buckets under it. There was a big number over the door of the building. The number was 5. Before the Americans could go inside, their only English-speaking guard told them to memorize their simple address in case they got lost in the big city. Their address was this: Schlachthaus 5. Schlachthaus meant slaughterhouse. 5 was good old 5. Billy Pilgrim got onto a chartered airplane in Ilium 25 years after that. He knew he was going to crash, but he didn't want to make a fool of himself by saying so. It was supposed to carry Billy and 28 other optometrists to a convention in Montreal. When the plane smacked into the top of Sugarbush Mountain in Vermont, everybody was killed but Billy and the co-pilot. So it goes. The people who first got to the crash scene were young Austrian ski instructors from the famous ski resort below. They spoke to each other in German as they went from body to body. They wore black wind masks with two holes for their eyes and a red topknot. They looked like gollywogs, like white people pretending to be black for the laughs they could get. Billy had a fractured skull, but he was still conscious. He didn't know where he was. His lips were working, and one of the gollywogs put his ear close to them to hear what might be his dying words. Billy thought the gollywog had something to do with the Second World War, and he whispered to him his address.